C1AN.
Number 5A.
Now, this morning, I want to take the text of the chapter Animal Magnetism Unmasked as we have it in the final edition of Science and Health. And in doing so, I naturally want to rely and fall back on what we have been considering yesterday afternoon in regard to the development of the chapter Animal Magnetism through the various editions and revisions of Science and Health. And we have seen that finally Mrs. Eddy regarded that whole chapter from the standpoint of truth and love, from the standpoint of truth, which shows that animal magnetism is a belief, an error, which has not one quality of truth, and from the standpoint of love, where she says that this belief is nothing, that animal magnetism is nothing. And so, before I start with the analysis of the text, I just want to read to you from the text various statements which give us that impression of the allness of God and the nothingness, the no-ness, the not-isness of animal magnetism. First, in the negative, she says there is no proof of the existence of animal magnetic fluids. The doctrine of animal magnetism has nothing in common with therapeutics or with physiology. It is not a remedial agent. In no instance is the effect of animal magnetism other than the effect of illusion. Animal magnetism has no scientific foundation. Animal magnetism possesses neither animal nor human qualities, neither intelligence, power, nor reality. The planets have no power over men. Evil is not power. The belief of animal magnetism has not one quality of truth. In reality, there is no mortal mind. Consequently, there is no transference of mortal thought. Animal propensities are by no means mental qualities which heal the sick. They which do such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. See, that's now how she depicts the nothingness of animal magnetism in various ways. And then going through the text and seeing the allness of it, we find statements like this: God governs all that is real. His power is neither animal nor human. There is but one real attraction, that of spirit. The pointing of the needle symbolizes this all-embracing power of the divine mind. Mind science is wholly separate from any halfway impertinent knowledge. Mind science is of God working out the purpose of good only. The maximum of good is the infinite God and his idea, the all in all. In Christian science, men can do no harm. It indicates the rightness of all divine action. Let this age sanction only such methods that are demonstrable in truth. Against such, there is no law. Can you see what the standpoint of this chapter is now compared with what we have been considering yesterday when going through the seven revisions, where we had all sorts of still a sense of duality, of a challenge between metaphysics and mesmerism, where we had all the demonology, or and then all the warfare of the dragon with the woman, and so on. But now she has come and finally arrived at the point where she reduced animal magnetism back and back and back and back until she saw it's only a belief in mortal mind, and the belief has no quality of truth, and there is no mortal mind. So if it is only a belief in mortal mind, it is devoid of truth, and therefore it is just a suppositional lie. So from that standpoint, she presents now the question of animal magnetism. And naturally, this standpoint is something very different than all the earlier revisions. So let's consider the text quickly from this standpoint. She has first a scriptural note which reads that, "For out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, blasphemies. These are the things which defile a man." So she introduces animal magnetism by depicting through scriptural symbolism the meaning of animal magnetism. And we remember that this scriptural note has been introduced into the textbook only after the sixth revision. That in the sixth revision, perhaps you remember that it was a different scriptural note where she had, "And have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather reprove them." So there it was an exhortation to do right, to do right. That's the tone of truth. Whereas here she goes to the symbol of love in its counterfeit here as the heart, as the counterfeit of the heart of love, namely to the heart of mortal men, the animal qualities, and shows that out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, that the heart is the cause, and not that evil thoughts really are the cause of malpractice and malicious animal magnetism or intentional animal magnetism, that thought and thinking and evil thinking is already an effect or a channel or a medium. But the cause of it, she points it out very clearly, is really the animal instincts, the heart of man. And actually here she means it in the negative as the sum total, so to say, of animal nature. We remember how already in the first edition she tried to touch on this point, where she said that students may destroy their position in scientific healing through falsehood, dishonesty, or sensuality. You see, that's the false sense of heart of man. Out of this come evil intentions. Or how she said that as mind is the medicine of scientific healing, shall then dishonesty, revenge, falsehood, or impurity be the stronger ingredient or quality of the practitioner's mind? See, here, there again she showed what should be the practitioner's mind, what should be the stronger ingredient or quality of that mind, and takes as that quality and ingredient, animal qualities, dishonesty, revenge, falsehood, impurity, and so on. Or you remember how we saw yesterday that in the third edition she pointed out that by writing that sensuality, envy, malice, hatred, and revenge must cooperate in the individual mind that can carry out demonology. So again we see that it is not so much the thought, the way of thinking that matters and that gives power to animal magnetism, but that it is more our whole animal makeup, the animal qualities in us, which give to evil thinking and evil intentions power to accomplish evil. Therefore, more and more I think we'll see how we have to go through the rebirth of spirit. That only being reborn of spirit, being reborn of spiritual qualities, not being changed just in mind. I always feel that's a very easy thing to do, and therefore I think that all those mental sciences which flourish so much in America in all ways and means and under all sorts of headings, that all these sciences of mind, so-called, they can attract a lot of people and very quickly, because it is very easy to change one's mind. Very easy. Instead of thinking this way, to think in that way. The mind is very, very adaptable, very flexible, and can change from one to the other very quickly. But that is not spiritual science, which Mrs. Eddy wants to show. That's why she had to find out that it is not enough to show that mind governs the body. She saw that that has been traduced very quickly by her students by using the mind evilly to control the body or the other fellow. And so she had to pierce through and show that that what she gives to the world is a rebirth where the animal qualities are being laid down, and where the spiritual qualities of men are being born and refreshed and rejuvenated in us. And that naturally is a much, much, much bigger task. It's not so easy to turn from sensuality to senselessness, from sinfulness to sinlessness, from hate to love. That's not so quickly done as to change one's opinion. The opinion can be changed very quickly. But our whole inward animal nature, that's why it's animal magnetism, it's not mental magnetism, it's not just hypnotism, it's animal in its deepest sense, that has to be changed. And as long as that is not changed, then we are always under the danger of malpracticing on us and on the other fellow. So I like that scriptural note as it is in the final edition, because it seems really to go to the pith of the chapter on animal magnetism. And now the text. The text has seven big subjects in the word order, and these subjects have subtones which, I say in the main, follow the Genesis order, except for the first tone. Every time I read that first subject, I just can't help seeing seven tones in it and not three. Perhaps if one looks at it another way, one might find three. But that doesn't disturb me. And especially because very often in her textbook Mrs. Eddy presents a chapter in the Genesis order and subtones and makes an exception either with the first subject, like in the chapter on creation, or makes an exception in the last subject, has instead of two tones, seven tones. Why it is, I don't know. Don't ask me, I don't know. And I'm not worried about it, and I leave it to revelation or correction. I may be wrong, or I may see something further on. So, don't make a point out of that, I don't know. I just take always the text as it is and as it speaks to me. I never go to the text and say, that should be in this and this order. I never do that. I always try to be unprejudiced towards the text and let that text tell me what it wants to tell me. So, this is the layout, and in the questionnaire I was a bit careful and only made a remark to the first and sixth subject in regard to subtones. And all the other subjects I didn't make any hint to subtones, because I feel that one or the other subject may not be seen so clearly in its subtones, though I think they are very clearly there. But we don't want to make acrobatics in layouts. What we want to do is just what animal magnetism doesn't want us to do, namely to be reborn of spiritual qualities. And in order to be reborn of spiritual qualities, it's much more important that we take in the spirit of a chapter, even if perhaps the clear intellectual layout is not yet satisfying or not yet clear in every detail. But let's therefore rather take them as natural as the text comes to each one, and if it comes to you a different way, all the better. We are not here to quarrel over a layout, we are just here to consider together the nature of a chapter, what it means, what it does, how it speaks to us, and how it will lead us on the way of life to a new world. The first subject that goes over two pages has definitely the tone of mind in the sense of investigation, and shows analysis what the basis of animal magnetism is. And I would epitomize, one can epitomize a subject in many ways, but I would epitomize it like this, that this first subject first wants to show that when investigating and analyzing the basis of animal magnetism, that we find out that this basis is imaginative and elusive. That it is imaginative and elusive. You see, she talks right from the standpoint of truth and love, where she is not just interested to see that there is, to investigate that there is such a thing as animal magnetism, but regards from the time point of view of truth and love and says, yes, the basis is elusive, hypothetical, imaginative, it's seeming, it's deceptive, it's not a real basis. And we have seen yesterday that really Mesmer, who introduced animal magnetism, mesmerism, animal magnetism, that he himself was trying to find a theory for the effects which he observed, and that his theory was changed time after time. Therefore, he always put forth a hypothesis. That's what we always have to do if we are face to face with a new observation which we want to explain. We start with a hypothesis. We put up a hypothesis, and then on that basis, we have a working hypothesis, try to see if that hypothesis is true or not, if it's conclusive or not. And those first two pages are a deep analysis, looking back retrospectively, so to say, over 100 years, from Mrs. Edelstein back to Mesmer's time. Mesmer introduced it in 1775. The first edition came out in 1875, exactly 100 years later, and retrospectively viewed, we can see now that animal magnetism must be regarded as a hypothesis which is wrong, which is false, which is elusive. How does she analyze this basis? And she does it as I see it. I say that as I see it, somebody may see it differently, as a sevenfold analysis, in which she first shows that animal magnetism builds on the hypothesis that there exists a so-called force which can be exerted by one living organism over another. That was Mesmer's hypothesis. See, it started with the basis there is a so-called force, and that this so-called force can be exerted by one living organism over another, be it that it is exerted by the planets on men or men on men, doesn't matter. And he had just that hypothesis, which he tried to investigate further. Then, as a subtone of spirit, she gives at once that citation from his proposition, namely that he regarded this so-called force as a material force, not as a mental force, but not as a psychological force. He never could see that, but as a material force, just as later on Quimby still believed in a material truth and in a material force. And so he says, this influence can only be disseminated through the substance of the nerves. I always feel that nerve cases have a lot to do with animal magnetism. That nerve cases are those who are so susceptible for the influence of all that's going on in the world and around that person, that they are too sensitive for everything, for every influence, for every remark, for every happening and that goes on, and through the substance of the nerves, believe that is the channel. So we see that the second a hypothesis which he put forward was that this so-called force, mind, is a material force, mind a spirit, and needs the medium of matter, the medium of nerves, in order to manifest itself. Then she goes on to a third point, to the investigation of the French government. It's all about investigation and reports that have been made by a commission, by the findings of that commission. And the findings of that commission is that they defined animal magnetism and the force as an Mesmer defined as an animal magnetic fluid, that this report by analysis found out that it is the power of imagination, or that it is due to the excitement of the senses, the excitement of the imagination. See, we now come to the definition from a scientific point, from a point of view of investigation, and to see that it must be defined differently, namely as the power of imagination, as the excitement of the imagination and the impressions made upon the senses. And that it is to be recorded in the history of error of the human mind as an important experiment upon the power of imagination. Then she goes further to the tone of principle, in which she now shows that this hypothesis is not conclusive, that it has no proof, no conclusive proof, and that they tested, you see, they tested in order to prove this hypothesis in that committee of 1837, and could see that animal magnetism offers no conclusive proof of its doctrine, and therefore no contribution to science, to physiology, or to therapeutics. So you can see how she builds up that subject, slowly, step by step. As it has no part of science, as it has no element of science in itself, therefore it cannot be constructive, it cannot be a help to mankind. And that's what she shows right afterwards in the tone of life. Life is always that which is constructive and helpful and brings the world forward. And the counterfeit of it is animal magnetism is not constructive but destructive. It is fatal for the practitioner and patient. She says that its effect upon those who practice it and upon their subject who do not resist it. You see, she's quite clear. And upon the subject who do not resist it, for those it is leads to moral and to physical death. If we don't resist animal magnetism, the influence of the world, whatever those influences are, be it astrology, necromancy, occultism, hypnotism, be it disease, be it politics, be it fears and anger and strife and agony and I don't know what, these are all so-called forces trying to influence our organism. And they all try to influence our organism through matter, through the medium of matter, by breaking down our nerves or our health or the function of our organism or the breaking down of our business, of our happiness, of our family, of whatever it is. It's always destructive. We just shouldn't shut our eyes to that. That as long as we leave the door open for anything but the allness and onlyness of God, animal magnetism works on us. If we laugh at animal magnetism or not, that doesn't matter. Then she shows in the subtone of truth that the argument that Mesmer had healing, that all, you know, that period of Mesmer was full of people, just full of people who had marvelous healings through all sorts of unorthodox means. At his time there was in South Germany and Switzerland a priest called Gassner, at the time of Mesmer, who performed the same marvelous results year after year by hundreds and hundreds of people, but on a quite a different hypothesis and on a quite different theory. He was a priest and therefore, and Mesmer was a scientist. So Mesmer looked for a scientific explanation and this priest looked for a religious explanation. And instead that Mesmer made like this, and I don't know what on the patient, that priest had a formula which he said, in the name of Christ Jesus, I command all the devils to go out from you. And then he was usually healed. And they performed, if one reads the history of that age, the old countries were full of all sorts of so-called unorthodox healing methods. And Mesmer was the one who challenged that priest Gassner. He went to the academy, medical academy in Munich, and I don't know the English term for all those principalities, the governor, it wasn't the king, the Herzog, a baroness or something of Bavaria, asked him to challenge Gassner. And he said, I'm going to do it. He said, I'm going to perform exactly the same phenomena as that priest Gossmer, but I do it on the basis of science.